All right, so let's go ahead and begin today's lecture. If everyone could go ahead and sit down. So I just wanted to give a note. I think there was a little bit of confusion, at least I heard, because on Wednesday, I did give two formulations for the microcanonical ensemble. And I believe I said this or this, and sometimes when we use or, it means actually that that second one is the same thing, but simplified. In this case, that's not what I meant. They're actually two different things. So they do give the same macroscopic results, but they are not equivalent at the microscopic level. They don't have the same normalization for one, but we talked about how with this, when we define this row, we aren't defining it to be normalized, a normalized probability density, because we're going to divide by the integral over rho anyway.
So how different are they? Because the above seems to me just like a definition of a data, of a delta function. But you're saying that there's some...
Well, the above one, it's equal to 1 when it's there, whereas a delta function we know goes to infinity at that value.
I see.
All right. So today we're going to start by thinking about the ergodic hypothesis. And this hypothesis is of interest because yesterday, or on Wednesday, we were thinking about the different ensembles and we were using them to compute averages. And ultimately with this work, we really are trying to make contact with the real world with experiment and know how to relate things, you know, to these properties of material, temperature, conductivity, energy, etc. And so the ergodic hypothesis is really about the connection between these canonical averages and the time averages that we see, that we would do for an experiment. So yeah, so let me just write this out. So we've been discussing ensemble averages. Where we're going to integrate over our phase space M. And if we're just thinking about it in the continuous formulation, we have our observable times the rho, and then we're integrating over our phase space Q and P. And then of course we normalize this. Okay. So what do these correspond to experimentally? Well, to think about if we were doing an experiment, we would take maybe multiple measurements of the system, and each one would occur at a different time. You know, we can only go forward in time. We will continue to take measurements. And so as we go, these Q and these Ps will all evolve in time. So I'm going to write it over here. So we are going to be taking a time average of measurements. Of the system, at times t1, t2, up to, let's say, some tn. So now I'm thinking about some average of the same observable a. I'm going to say average over time. I'm going to do 1 over the total number of measurements times the sum, let's just say from, let's run L equals 1 to N A of Q at TL and P at TL. And as I mentioned, when we're thinking about this Q and P, these are trajectories. Governed by Hamilton's equations. So is this clear what I'm talking about for this average versus the ensemble average that we've been discussing? Now, if we think about how these averages are related to each other, and we think about, importantly, the system being at equilibrium, well, equilibrium, we have that rho is not going to change in time. And the averages are independent procedures. I was going to say something slightly different. Let's see. They are independent procedures, but I'm going to say, and the ensemble average is independent of time since rho doesn't change. So we're going to have that the ensemble average, we could say, is also equal to some time average of the ensemble average. And I mean, this is a pretty trivial statement. We're just saying the ensemble average doesn't change in time. So let's take the ensemble average at one time when we're in equilibrium. Let's take the ensemble average at a different time when we're in the equilibrium, and so on. And you know, we'll always get this same average. And then the second part is time averaging and ensemble averaging. Completely independent. So we can also say that ensemble average is equal to first taking a time average And then for each one of those times in the time average, doing the ensemble average afterwards. So, you know, this all is fairly straightforward. And then now we're going to get to the hypothesis part. So the ergodic hypothesis is basically, if you take this time average, but if you take this time average in equilibrium for long enough time period for enough times, then you don't have to do this ensemble average, and you could just say it's exactly equal to the ensemble. So it's basically that A time over a sufficiently long time with sufficiently many measurements must be the same for every member of the ensemble. And so this makes it so that the ensemble average is equal to this time average when the time is long. So that we can have then this A ensemble to be something like A experiment. So this is something we can obtain with experiments. So the important thing is we've moved from something this A time, which if I give the definition up there, this would be something very hard for us to compute analytically, or maybe impossible with these Hamilton's equations. We've moved something for something very hard to something that, as we've seen for examples yesterday and examples on Wednesday, something that is much more tractable to compute theoretically. What do we have to assume in order for this to be the case? So let's flesh that out a little bit more. So the ergodic hypothesis, which was originally discussed by Boltzmann, it basically requires that the trajectory of any point in the phase space can pass in its time evolution. Through every other point. In the non-zero row phase space. Because if something has a zero weight, you know, that's okay. We don't want to get to it. But if we think about our phase space, M, and we think about a point, what would cause a problem, basically, for this ergodic hypothesis? What would make this fail? Yeah, I saw you kind of split your hands, you know? What if we had, like, some set of row equals zero weights, and we just sort of had a line of them going through? You know, that sort of thing would break this. We couldn't get from any point to any other point. So this would be an example where because you wouldn't then be able to get from every point in phase space to every other point from the trajectories. Now, there were refinements later on, since this is really a continuous thing. There's an idea of the quasi-ergodic hypothesis. And that is just that the trajectory of any point traverses through the neighborhood of the relevant system, of the relevant region. And you can read about that, these works by Terhar. And then Farquhar. So one of the important things in this course is we aren't going to prove it for our particular systems. Instead, we're going to treat it as a working hypothesis. And we verify validity by comparing with experiment.
Ask why is the statement about the ergodic hypothesis and the trajectories in the phase space true? I mean, I can see why this has to be the case.
Why is the statement about the ergodic?
The trajectory has to pass through every point in the phase space. I can see why.
Oh, you can't see why. Right. So what we want to say is that this ensemble is going to be the same as this time average up there. Now, the ensemble, when we compute it ourselves, that's a simple thing. We are just going to put all of the rows, all of the weights in there, no matter what this kind of topology, or, you know, no matter what this landscape of the phase space looks like. But if you think about with an experiment, and if you were sitting somewhere in phase space here, and then you took a bunch of data points over time, and there really was some kind of zero row line here keeping you from getting to anywhere else, this result would then be different from that average just of everything.
Because we wouldn't have access to the points on the other side.
Yeah, we wouldn't have access to the points over here in the phase space. Any other questions? I mean, related to this too, it's sort of it's a bit more of a conceptually deep.
So the quasi-ergodic hypothesis is a weaker statement than the ergodic one.
That's right. It's a relaxed statement.
Yeah.
Basically saying if you could get into a small enough neighborhood, then your average should still be the same.
So that's good enough for like experiment and stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
So does the first hypothesis mean that each point, the trajectory of each point must eventually explore all the phase space?
Absolutely, yes. Okay. So you could just pick any random point and you would eventually get to any of the other random points in the phase space.
Okay.
Now some you are much more likely to reach than others, and that's good because some have a greater weight than others, but you can explore, and where you would run into a problem really would be if there was some sort of rho equals zero way of, you know, blocking off. Maybe there are other high weight areas here that should be actually sampled, you know, to get them to match up.
So it means that for this hypothesis to be true for all systems, that we must have some strong condition on the Hamilton's equations, and we don't want that. Is that because the trajectory will be governed by Hamilton's equations?
Yeah, so the trajectory is governed by Hamilton's equations. The assumption is that this would not be a typical physical situation where we just have this line of zeros keeping us from accessing everything else. The assumption would be that in the experimental situation, we would really be able, through Hamilton's equations, explore our system freely. But it's not proven in many cases. But yeah, it really would have to be proven to be able to say for sure that this average over time, over a long enough time, is equal to the ensemble average. All right, so I'm going to move on now to the topic of quantum gases. And really thinking about the two fundamental types of particles we have, fermions and bosons, and what we can learn about them using the canonical and then the grand canonical ensembles. So here we'll model fermions and bosons in a pseudo-classical way. Using the canonical and grand canonical ensembles. So we'll still be putting quantum assumptions into this calculation, but we are still going to stick with our row that is a density function. We're not going to do a density matrix and do the quantum formulation of this. I am going to discuss that later in the course, what it would look like to really start with your quantum Hilbert space rather than this, these classical trajectories of rho and q. But for now, we'll stick with these classical ones. Okay. So we're going to have a system of n non-interacting particles. And today is going to be the last day really treating particles without interactions. In the coming weeks, we'll start adding in the interactions. But for now, still non-interacting, which means that you can easily solve the Hamiltonian in terms of these single particle states. And so I'm just going to give a representation. Where we would have our different energy level solutions. And for each of these, we could have some number of particles in the energy level. So I'm going to say N0, N1, N2, N3, N4. And then it's a simple thing where you can just say that the total energy is going to be equal to the sum of all these single particle energy states, or single particle energies, that is, multiplied by the number of particles that have each of those energies. Number of particles with energy n lambda. So if we're thinking about the canonical ensemble first, then we're going to have that the total number of particles is going to be equal to the sum of all these little n's for each of the single particle states. And then we can write the partition function as a sum over all the possible energies you could have. And then I'm going to rewrite that in a way similar to how I did on Wednesday, where I'm going to divide it up into a sum over all of the particle configurations. So, you know, how many particles are in each one of these? You know, this is just like a combination of N0, N1, up to N, I don't know. And then for this, the point is that this also is going to have the condition that when we add up all of these n lambdas, we better be equal to big N. So this is a special summation that's limiting ourselves to these combinations where we still are keeping the total number of particles fixed. And so then I can say it's this times some g factor, which I will get to, times e to the minus beta, and then we need the energy, which is just the sum over lambda, little n lambda, epsilon lambda. And this factor is what we're going to use to distinguish fermions from bosons. Because right now, I haven't actually specified what type of particle I'm talking about. And so, does anyone want to say what's special about fermions? At least in the context of this problem.
You cannot have more than one.
Exactly. You cannot have more than one fermion per energy level. So when we're thinking about this G factor, we're going to have the G for a particular set of n lambda is equal to 1 for bosons, because here we really are just doing our summation over all the combinations while keeping big N fixed. That makes sense. That's a standard partition function. But then for fermions, it's going to be equal to either 1 or 0. So it's only equal to 1 if all n lambda equals 0, 1, and then 0 otherwise. And this is for fermions. Okay, so that's the canonical ensemble. It actually ends up being much simpler to write these things and then simplify them using the grand canonical ensemble. So this is what we're going to move to next, if everyone's happy with this expression for the partition function in the canonical ensemble. Well, from on Wednesday, we had this formula where we can write the grand partition function in terms of the partition function for the canonical ensemble using e to the mu n over kt times the partition function that we've defined up there. So we can take this and let's just substitute in what we have. Now we have e to the mu, and I'm going to actually replace the capital N with the sum. Oh, well, no, I'll do that in a moment. Yeah, I can do that now. Okay. Sum over lambda mu little n lambda over kt, and then let's put in what we have for this. We have the sum over these configurations of the n's times g and lambda e to the minus beta times the sum over lambda and lambda epsilon lambda. So I've gone ahead and replaced this big N with a sum over the little n's. And so we actually have this part with the n lambdas. Oh, that's why. I think it's fine. So So, no, yeah, yeah. So that if I'm going to write it this way, I should go ahead, because those little n lambdas are defined by those the configuration. So I've gone ahead and put this inside the sum. Now we know that this is always going to equal a constant, which is why we could have it outside. But now that I'm going to use these little n lambdas, they're defined according to this configuration. So that's why I need to put it in that order. And then I'm going to do one more thing here, since I have a sum over these little n lambdas. I'm going to put g n lambda here. And then I have a sum over them, but they're in an exponential, so I can rewrite the sum as a product instead. And then both of these also have an n lambda in common. So I'm going to rewrite it in terms of powers of these. Have this term that's gone here. We have this term with beta and epsilon lambda, which is gone here. And then both of them have the n lambda. So they're raised to the n lambda power, since that's the same as multiplying the exponents.
Sorry, where does the product come from?
Sorry?
Where does the product come from?
Yeah, the product comes from the fact that here we have up in the exponent, we have summations over these lambdas. So then we can just write it as a product over lambdas instead. And then the other nice thing to notice, actually, is that we had a sum of all these configurations of n to add up to a big N. And then we had the sum over all of the big N particles. But now we do have a sum over the big N particles. So we are actually saying these configurations could and should add up to all of the possible Ns. So that means that we don't have to do this special restricted sum anymore. We can just write it as a sum of all possible N combinations. This is why it gets simpler in the grand canonical ensemble. And then I'm just going to write these out as terms, e to the minus beta epsilon naught and naught. E to the mu over kt, e to the minus beta epsilon 1, and 1, and so on, for all the n's, all the energies we could have. And so we don't need this constraint anymore, since we are really summing over all possible combinations of n, because they can add up to any big n that we would like. And then I'm going to do one last simplification before I switch to looking at the fermions versus the bosons. Since I have a sum over all of these things, and they're really sort of independent of each other, except for these G factors that would correspond to everything, we can actually rewrite this as a product of a bunch of sums. And so now we've slowly split them up. I mean, for fermions, we're just policing each one of these individual sums and saying, hey, and it's not really as much of a G of some combination of zero as it's just G of N zero, I suppose, at this case. But if any of the N zeros are something other than one and zero for the fermions, you would just have zero then. So these are all going to become binomial terms. In the case of the fermions, in the case of the bosons, we're going to get an infinite series. Now, does it make sense going from this step to this step? Does anyone have some questions about that?
Mm-hmm. For the definition of G, the G, I thought it depends on the set of n lambda itself. So I also.
Yeah. It might be better to just say now we have a G of n, like just this function of n zero,
okay.
You know, because this is just if it's one, if n zero is anything other than zero or one, then it's zero for the fermions. Now for bosons, it's always equal to one, anyway.
Oh, okay.
I will go ahead and align these boards. And then move on over here. So now we're at the stage where we can separate out the fermionic and the bosonic cases. So for bosons, I'm just going to call this quantity X. Because as you can see for the bosons, you're going to sum over N0 equals 0, 1, 2, 3, all the way to infinity here. And so if I call the argument there X, what we want to do is we want to compute this series that you're probably familiar with, the geometric series. And does anyone remember a little trick you can do with this one? to figure out what it's equal to at the end. Yeah. So I can take this same series, I can multiply it by x. So 1 goes becomes x becomes x squared becomes x cubed, and so on. So that's equal to x times the same sum. And then you can just subtract these. And on the left-hand side, it's all the same except we have an extra 1 here. Well, yeah, let's figure out which one. So I'm going to do s minus xs. Yeah, so if I do this minus that, I just have an extra 1. And so then you can say that s is equal to 1 over 1 minus x. And so we're just going to apply that formula then to what we have here. And each one of these terms is a geometric series, and each one of them is going to turn into 1 over 1 minus x, where this quantity in here is x. So for bosons, we say that z is equal to a product over these lambdas, 1 over 1 minus e to the mu, our x value, mu over kt e to the minus beta epsilon lambda. Well, the fermion one is going to be pretty trivial. I mean, more trivial than that one, which didn't take too long. But what's the fermion partition function then going to look like?
Product of lambda 1 plus x.
That's right. Product of lambda 1 plus x. So we're just going to get 1 plus e to the mu over kt e to the minus beta epsilon lambda. So yeah, then maybe I'll just put it over here so we can keep it in mind for problems. We have that the partition function is equal to product over lambda, this 1 over 1 minus e to the beta mu minus beta epsilon lambda. That's Bose-Einstein. And then we have product over lambda 1 plus e to the beta mu minus beta e lambda. And that's Fermi-Dirac. Okay, so now that we have these, let's tease out the implications of these formulas. And one way you can do that is by getting expressions for the mean occupation number for each one of them. Which is basically just the average number of particles that you would see in energy state lambda. So how would we get that? Well, one thing to say is if you took 1 over minus beta, the partial derivative with respect to E lambda ln of z, and if you're just thinking in terms of the original definitions that we had of these functions, that would just be first 1 over the partition function times the derivative of the partition function with respect to epsilon lambda. And so that would be a sum over our big N and our N lambda configurations. And then remember the expression was e to the beta sum over N lambda mu minus epsilon lambda. And when you take the derivative with respect to epsilon lambda, that's this part, you're going to get a minus beta, and then you're going to get an N lambda. So you can see simply looking at the original definition of the partition function that you can use, formula in order to get the mean occupation number. And so now what we're going to do is we're going to look at it for the expressions, the simplified expressions that we've obtained for the Bose-Einstein condensate and sort of the Bose-Einstein distribution in the Fermi-Dirac. So for fermions, we have that N lambda is equal to minus 1 over beta. And then in the denominator, we're just going to have a product of all those binomial terms, because remember it was the derivative of the log of it. So first you do 1 over the thing. And then in the numerator, we're doing the derivative with respect to a particular E lambda. So first I'm going to have a product over lambda prime not equal to lambda. Actually, let me call this one lambda prime 2, just to keep these as dummy variables. And so then I'm going to have all the pieces where it's not. And then I have the one term that I then have to take the derivative of. So that's minus beta. And as you can see, all of these will cancel except for one of the terms. And so what you'll be able to do at the end is simplify it as just 1 over e to the beta epsilon lambda minus mu plus 1. And that's just because all of these will cancel except one of them. So you'll have this term. And then notice the signs in the exponent here are opposite of the signs in this term. That's just because I divided the numerator and the denominator through by this term. And that allows me to arrive at this expression here. For bosons, you can do something similar. And you get that N lambda is equal to 1 over e to the beta epsilon lambda minus mu minus 1. And if we think about then what these look like, we can plot them. So for fermions, if we're plotting we're just going to plot beta times e to epsilon lambda minus mu. So it's increasing as we go this way. So if we think about it going to infinity, we know we're going to go to zero particles. If we think about it going to minus infinity, if this part goes to zero, then what does the full thing go to? If this goes to minus infinity, this exponent, then what does this whole thing go to? Because you have e to the minus infinity, basically, right? So that part should go to zero, right? And so we should just get one. So that means it'll approach one, basically, from one side asymptotically. And then when it's at zero, we're going to be at 1/2, and then it'll approach zero in this direction. If I think about the boson expression, and I should put what this is n lambda. I'm going to plot the same things. Now for the bosons, it's different. If we think about this number, what happens when this expression is equal to zero?
Goes to infinity.
Yeah, we're gonna get e to the zero, which is one. We have one minus one in the denominator, it goes to infinity. Now, of course, if we think about the other way, when we're just taking this to plus infinity, it's the same as the fermions. Adding one, subtracting one isn't going to make a difference. But the point is, for bosons, we get a plot that looks like this. And I wanted us to keep these plots in mind, because when we think about the bosons for the Bose-Einstein condensation, we're going to set our energy levels so that the smallest energy is zero. And so that means we are going to assume for those problems that this chemical potential is less than zero for the bosons. Because if the energy is zero, then that would put us on this side. We're going to keep, we're going to stay here because that's where it makes sense physically. So chemical potential here, we're going to keep zero. Here, the chemical potential, you can see. It actually, if you set epsilon zero, if you take this chemical potential to be large and positive, if it's large and positive, that pulls you over here, and that brings you up to one particle per energy level. If you take the chemical potential to be large and negative, that takes you down to zero. So the point with the fermions is that chemical potential, will change the particles from either the extremes where you have zero particles at any site, no matter where you are at any state, to one particle at each state, no matter which state you're talking about. So those are sort of the limits for the fermions. Let's go ahead and take a break until 11:55, and then I'll continue.
So how does this look like for anions?
Say again?
How does this look like for anions?
For anions? I don't know. I mean, so the anions, I mean, well, they can have a variety of different factors that you get when they commute with each other and whatnot. So I guess the question is what that means for their occupation number limitations here. So that would be the question to ask for them, you know, how many anions are you allowed to have in each state? Okay, so let's think a bit more about the specifics of fermions and bosons, and particularly what happens to them at low temperature or zero temperature, because these are phenomena that really will form the basis of a lot of interesting things that you see in quantum matter and whatnot, so and in other courses. These are sort of some of the things you will assume to understand. Okay, so let's let mu naught be mu at zero temperature. So we're just thinking about the fermions at zero temperature right now. So we know that n lambda for the fermions is 1 over e to the beta epsilon minus epsilon lambda minus mu plus 1. And what we want to do is we want to look at as beta goes to infinity for this quantity. And so we're going to look at it in two cases. So first of all, let's look at when epsilon lambda is less than this mu naught. So when epsilon lambda is less than mu naught, that means that this quantity here is going to be negative. So what happens then when you take beta to infinity here? Like I said, epsilon lambda is less than mu naught, so that's going to make this negative. So then if I take beta to infinity, I'm going to get this, which is what? What's this, really? And I'm being sloppy of here. Of course, in math, you would write the limit as this thing goes to infinity. But what would this be equal to? It's a simple one in this case.
Just 1.
Yeah, just 1. Okay. And then let's look on the other hand when epsilon is greater than mu naught. Then when epsilon is greater than mu naught, I'm going to get something positive here. So if I take beta to infinity there, it's going to be e to the positive infinity. And so what is this going to be equal to?
Mm-hmm. Zero.
Yeah, this one goes to zero. So that means with the fermionic case at zero temperature, if I'm looking at n lambda as a function of lambda, as a function of e lambda, then wherever this chemical potential is, we're simply going to have an occupation number that is 1 until we hit the chemical potential, and then we jump down to 0. So at 0 temperature, these expressions that we have are really just telling us that the fermions are going to fill in all the energy levels that they can until they hit the chemical potential, which sets the number of fermions. So they fill in all the fermions into the lowest levels until they run out of fermions. And then that's what you have, basically. And so as a note, you can figure out, this is also called the Fermi energy. And so for a number of fermions, you can say that N is equal to the summation from 0 to the Fermi energy, dQ(P) dQ(Q). But then since we're talking about energies here, you need to use the density of states. And so then with the density of states, you can then do this integral. And then that will give you the total number of particles. And I will give you some notes that actually show the details of this because I'm running low on time. But basically, when you do this, you will get 4/3 pi volume h cubed 2m to the 3/2 times this Fermi energy to the 3/2. And so then you can solve for the Fermi energy in terms of the number of particles. And then this, I just want to note, you can relate to a Fermi momentum. Because I'm thinking about this problem in particular in three dimensions. And then, and so when you have this quantum gas, this fermionic gas at zero temperature, you have a Fermi surface, and it's really a Fermi sphere. And so what I'm doing is I'm thinking about things in momentum space. And then this is really in 3D. There's another axis. And so the point is, if you're thinking about the energy states that get filled up in momentum space, it's everything out to a sphere of this radius that is the Fermi momentum. And so this is something that you'll see in condensed matter and other courses related to that you have a Fermi surface for quantities. And in the case of zero temperature for this gas, it's very simple. It's just a sphere, and it fills up to that radius, PF. So this is another way of representing all the states. You know, I've got the states here filled up to the Fermi energy, or I've got the states filled up in this 3D momentum space up to this radius PF.
Mm-hmm. So the spherical shell represents the Fermi surface?
Yeah, yeah, and it's not really a spherical shell, it's a sphere, because you've got everything up to that Fermi momentum, all the momenta lower than that, too. But yeah, I guess Fermi surface, yeah, yeah, I suppose it's a spherical shell, yeah, I see. So those are the basics of fermions that you can get from those statistics. Let's turn to the bosons and see how we can get Bose-Einstein condensation. So as a reminder, we have this expression for the average occupation number for a particular energy state of the bosons. And here, like I said, we're going to assume mu, the chemical potential, to be a negative number. And we're going to set the lowest single particle energy in our spectrum to be E0 equals 0, because we have these energy levels and we can really start them wherever we want, add some constant, subtract some constant. So the lowest energy is going to be equal to 0. And it's really because of that that we have this assumption then mu is negative. And one thing that I sort of skipped over was that I did an integral here over it was a continuous integral, you know, over these continuous energies. But I originally assumed they were discrete. And so that's for mathematical ease. If you have a large enough volume, the spectrum of the single particle states gets denser and denser. And so you can really approximate it in that way. So that's for a large volume of particles is the important thing. So we're going to do the same thing for the bosons. And I'll just put large volume in parentheses, so it's clear why we're doing that. And so we have N if we think about the total number of bosons, well, originally it was the sum, and now we're going to have it actually be an integral over 1 over e to the beta epsilon minus mu minus 1 d cubed p d cubed q. And of course, when you're looking at this, this is in terms of energies, this is in terms of momentum. We need to integrate over the over a common variable here. And so again, we're going to need the density of states. I'll give a couple more details here because the form ends up being relevant for this problem. So for one thing, if I think about d cubed p, I'm integrating over momentum, and it's in a sphere of momentum. So I can write this as p squared dp times the solid angle, because I have that rotational symmetry in the momentum space. Because the energy is just equal to p squared over 2m. It just relies on the magnitude of the momentum here. And it's the same no matter what the angle of your momentum vector actually is. So then you can say that dE dP is equal to P over M, or d energy or d epsilon is equal to P over M dP. And then we almost have what we want. This we can also solve and get that P is equal to the square root of 2m times the energy. And so then we can get that P squared dP is going to be equal to m d epsilon. And then I need one more P. So I have m times the square root of 2m epsilon d epsilon. And so this is really how you are going to obtain the density of states. And this whole thing is assuming non-relativistic particles. So we're going to see the boson and condensation phenomenon for non-relativistic particles. There are ways to see it for relativistic as well, but we are going to stick with that for this calculation. So the important thing then is that this integral is going to go something like 1 over e to the beta times epsilon minus mu minus 1 times the square root of epsilon d epsilon when we do the integration. And so notice that when epsilon equals 0, we're going to have that the square root of epsilon equals 0. And so this whole integral, when epsilon is equal to 0, doesn't contribute anything to the total number of particles. Now, it turns out that is a very unphysical thing. The zero energy state definitely should contribute to this, and it turns out that it makes a very important contribution. So we are going to make one correction to this. and we're going to write then that the total number of n equals, and I'm going to fill in the constants here, but I will send you copies of the notes so you can see how we arrived at these things. But we're going to have that first integral I was talking about. But then I'm going to go ahead and just add, because remember, this was originally a discrete sum that included a piece where epsilon was epsilon 0. And I said epsilon 0 is going to be equal to 0 here. So I'm going to add the piece that's just e to the minus beta mu. The e part is 0, so now it's just e to the minus beta mu minus 1. And so I'm going to write the number of particles in this way. And I'm going to call this part of the sum NE for excited. Because this piece of this total number of particles is going to give the number of particles that are in excited states at greater than epsilon equals 0. And then this piece is the number of particles that are going to be and the lowest energy state, the epsilon zero state. So this is N zero and N excited. Okay. So there's a useful mathematical identity that we can use. Which is that if you have this integral over some x to some power nu minus 1 over e to the minus beta mu e to the x minus 1, this is equal to the gamma function of nu times some infinite series e to the beta mu plus e to the 2 beta mu over 2 to the nu plus e to the 3 beta mu over 3 to the nu, and so on. And so remember, this chemical potential we said is negative, so that's fine. This is going to be some number, some finite number. As we take powers of it, it'll go to 0, and then we've also got these new values. Okay, so we can write NE, and I'm just going to show you after doing a substitution. X to the 1/2 dx e to the minus beta mu e to the x minus 1. And this comes simply from, so we want an e to the x here. Right. So I'm just saying then that x is equal to beta times epsilon. And so when I make that substitution, then I'll get some factor down here, some extra beta, and then I will be able to have this in the form that we want. And so, we have x to the nu minus 1. So then what is nu going to be in this case when we're trying to use this formula?
Three halves,
exactly. So we're going to say nu is going to equal 3/2. And so that's actually then the gamma function of 3 halves is equal to pi squared over 2. But that's not so important. It's just a number there. The important thing is then we can say that NE is equal to pi V over H cubed 2MKT to the 3 halves. And we've got our gamma 3 halves. And then we have our sum. Over 2 to the 3 halves plus e to the 3 beta mu over 3 to the 3 halves and then the point is again that mu is, well, we could say less than or equal to 0, but really less than 0 because it blows up there. And so then this is going to be bounded by what we have if you just had a 1 in each of these. And that's equal to the zeta function. Zeta function of 3 halves is 1 plus 1 over 2 to the 3 halves. Plus 1 over 3 to the 3 halves, and so on. And so then we get gamma of 3 halves times zeta of 3 halves. So the important thing is that the number of particles in excited states is bounded. So for a particular temperature that you have, there are only so many particles that you are able to put in an excited state. So that means if you have more particles than that, all the rest of them have to actually go into the lowest energy state, the E0 state. And so you have that N0, the number of particles in the epsilon 0 state, is equal to N minus N, the number of particles in excited state, or NE max, the number of particles that we could fit there, which is this N minus and then you could ask at what temperature do we get this phenomenon? Because really what it comes down to is temperature. If temperature is high enough, then you can fit enough particles in this NE max and you don't have this. But there is a critical temperature that you can get by saying here you don't see the gamma function because I went ahead and put in the value for the gamma function. And so you can solve for a TC. And when T is greater than TC, you're in a normal phase, you know, with a normal distribution. And then when T is less than TC, you are in a condensed phase. So I'm just gonna leave you with a plot for this. Looking at T over TC as you increase. So at one, that's T equal to TC. And then we're looking at T greater than TC and T less than TC. And we're going to plot two fractions of NE versus N0. So if we look at the extreme case, when we're at T equals zero for bosons, you find that the fraction, this fraction corresponds to this line, this fraction corresponds to this line. So when you're here, you find that this fraction is one. That means that all of the particles are in N zero, or all of the particles are in the lowest energy state. On the other hand, as you increase the temperature to TC, this fraction goes lower and lower and lower until it's negligible, until it's zero. And then you find that all the particles are distributed across the system. They're all in, you know, this NE. And so this is what you see in three dimensions. One other remark in 2D, TC is actually zero. It turns out that in 2D, when you do this stuff, you end up with nu equal to one, and you get our friend the harmonic series that always means weird things, and you know it diverges. So you don't actually get a boundedness on the NE in two dimensions. So in two dimensions, you have to go all the way down to zero temperature to see all the particles in the zero state. But in 3D, you will have a TC that you can compute, and below that you get this Bose-Einstein condensation. So yeah, that's really what I wanted to say about this, and I will give you some copies of notes that fill in some of the details.